Hello and welcome to the Queen Core podcast. I am your host, Carolyn King. With the rise in spirituality in an unstable world, there's a new focus on a power known as the divine feminine, goddess and queen energies, especially on social media. Hashtag queen. People are connecting in with the confidence and the power that this stands for, which is often at odds with the world that we live in. However, this queen energy is not just for the ladies. It's not about gender identity or biological sex, but ancient empowering energies that predate language itself. It's both strong and vulnerable all at once. So by exploring this rise in the so-called Insta goddess, we discuss how this impacts on music industry professionals and their lives. Let's welcome the goddess in. This week's guest is Welsh songwriter, multi-instrumentalist and producer, The Anchoress, also known as Catherine Ann Davies, fresh from her interview with Sir Elton John. So let's meet The Anchoress and welcome the goddess in.
Are you a spiritual person?
It's strange because I was thinking about this question today, and then I heard your kind of horoscope little feature that you have in the middle of the podcast, and I thought, well, actually, I am, because I'm steeped in that. When I grew up, my mum was really obsessed with horoscopes, but as in not the kind of the ones you read in the papers or the magazines, like proper kind of your ninth house is in this and your conservatory's in Libra and all of that kind of stuff. The makeup of my brain probably is deeply steeped in spirituality, whereas I think of myself as a radically logical person. So I'm a little bit at war with myself over it. I think if I frame it in terms of feminine spirituality, I think it's something that I'm warming up towards, definitely. It's a work in progress, I would say, as I tend to cast myself as somebody who's incredibly rational, incredibly sort of enthralled to science and incredibly enthralled to empirical evidence, I guess, which feels kind of counter to the spiritual, but it isn't, is it? If we dig down a bit deeper, there's a can of worms to open.
Yeah, absolutely. Things like the law of attraction are grounded in science, apparently used by Albert Einstein as well, and some sort of, you know, mathematical force. So yeah, there is aspects of that in the spirituality that we're referring to. Because you are a doctor, right? You have a PhD.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, was that a very logical process, the conducting that PhD?
Definitely. I mean, my PhD was primarily in queer theory, so it was really kind of deeply entrenched in the idea that our identities are constructed and performed, that gender is performed, and it is kind of culturally ingrained in us rather than something that is biologically based, which I think people are, again, warming up to the idea of that at the moment. I've always found solace in facts and figures and learning things and holding on to kind of like concrete numbers. I was always a massive science buff at school. And again, I was thinking about it today, is like, I'm not sure if it was a bit of a reaction maybe to my mum being quite spiritual and quite in love with things that didn't necessarily have grounding in science. And we all like to rebel, don't we, against our parents, I think, to some extent. But I think I was going to say, as I've become a bit older, I think, and especially over the past few years, having kind of navigated quite a lot of loss and trauma, I've really kind of come back to this idea of much more trusting my own intuition and not seeing that as something that's counter to science, but something that is deeply embedded in human psychology. I did a whole course of trauma-based therapy that was really about coming around to the idea that the brain needs to store trauma to some extent. It's an evolutionary advantage for us to remember that that mushroom is poisonous, or remember to avoid those types of people, or to run from the men that make you give you that kind of feeling. And I think in the past, I had kind of really repressed my connections with my deep female intuition, which I guess is what we're talking about when we think about female spirituality. So yeah, I'm coming home to that now.
That's amazing. So you're at this sort of tipping point where you're sort of tipping into that and actually utilising that every day, would you say? Yeah,
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I think it was always there, and I didn't really realise that it was entrenched in a lot of the music that I loved when I was, you know, a preteen and a teenager. You know, I remember the kind of my gateway album into the alternative world being Boy Sapele by Tori Amos, which is obviously a deeply spiritual record in all senses, you know, not necessarily in the kind of Christian sense, but even down to the cover and the way it's kind of referencing, you know, nurturing the profane, nurturing that which is not kosher, and how deeply she's kind of tapping into the divine feminine on that record. I think I just never had labelled it like that. I just sort of labelled it as strong woman, strong female, someone who's angry, someone who is not following the gender norms that perhaps I had thought that women had to be timid and to be people pleasers. It's probably more about me redefining what the female divine means. I think it's not necessarily actually that I've been refusing it. It's just that I've not been acknowledging it by its name.
Absolutely, yeah, and you're so right. Tori Amos is such an embodiment of that. I mean, I know that you've experienced a lot of hardships over the past few years, and I mean, certainly during lockdown, for me, things like gratitude journaling has become such an everyday occurrence for me now, and I feel like it really helps me set the intention for my day. Have you got any spiritual practices like that?
Again, it's so interesting, isn't it, that they're framed as spiritual practices, and yet I kind of file them under things that my psychologist has told me to do, or things that I've learned in therapy. And yeah, I'm placing that label on, this is science, this is medicine, this is, you know, that was definitely something when I was trying to come to terms with multiple miscarriages. Certainly making lists of things that I was grateful for just to get me through the day was something that I found really helpful and was sort of prescribed to me by one of the clinical psychologists that I was seeing. Yeah, I guess there was some comfort in it coming from a doctor, and you think, oh, well, this is, you know, this is medicine of sorts. It's medicine for the mind. It's a practice. And I think there is that real blurred boundary, isn't there, between what we class of as spiritual practice and is therefore belongs in a different realm to those things that nourish us physically or mentally, whereas actually it's much more of a blurred boundary, really, if we think about the bigger question of even why religious and spiritual practices exist. What it is, what's the purpose of religion or spiritual practice? You know, what does it bring to us as a kind of human race? And I've always kind of thought of it as, you know, it's the stories that we tell ourselves to make sense of the experiences that we have, which is in a way what songwriting is, isn't it? And they're so connected to one another that whatever religion it is, what they all have in common is they're a way of narrativizing the human experience and placing a kind of bigger hermeneutic meaning on that. And again, I think there's a false binary set up, isn't there, about what is science and what is religion, and that the two are opposed in some way. But they kind of meet in the middle in something really simple like gratitude journaling, which is a very scientifically based neural reprogramming way of reinforcing those positive connections in the brain. And, you know, that falls neither into science nor into spirituality completely, but it sort of straddles the two.
Yeah, it's incredibly useful, and it's so nice to hear that you found that helpful. I find it incredibly helpful day to day. Is the anchoress like a sort of alter ego for you?
Yeah, well, that also actually has its connection to the spiritual and the female divine, actually. So it comes from an anchorite, a religious hermit. The original idea of an anchoress was, I guess, a kind of proto-nun. So it would have been a woman who devoted her life to religious contemplation. And she lived in an annex, but sort of like a cell-like annex that would be attached to a church, but you'd be bricked in completely. Like, there's no door, no window, no nothing. So essentially you're buried alive, and you are devoting your life entirely to contemplative, meditative life. So yeah, the anchoress was sort of like a religious hermit, basically. And when I was making the first record, I was really trying to work out whether I wanted to release music under my own name. I felt really uncomfortable about that. And I just happened to be watching The One Show one night, which is really unglamorous, isn't it? And this mini documentary came on about the anchoress. And I thought, God, that sounds a little bit like what it's like making a record. You know, I'd been stuck in this really small room, this kind of like 10 by 10 room with a really tiny window, like not having much contact with outside world. And so it was sort of a little bit of an inside joke, really, was that life was a little bit like that for me. And it kind of stuck. It felt really comfortable. It felt like a kind of alter ego to hide behind, really. And it just allows me to, I guess, explore different ideas and to say things and for people not to necessarily assume they're autobiographical as well.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you. So a large aspect of the divine feminine is that they are not afraid to be vulnerable. And of course, The Art of Losing as an album is so vulnerable. Were you worried about putting that out there?
Definitely. I definitely was. I mean, it was such an about turn, conceptually speaking, from my first album, Confessions of a Romance Novelist, which had been, you know, completely constructed around fictional persona. And then here I was, having made a deeply personal album that was entirely autobiographical. I guess luckily, you know, the only positive of the pandemic was that it meant there was a much longer hiatus before the album was released. So rather than being quite close to some of the events that I talk about on the album, I'd had some time to have some, you know, really intense therapy and to really get a little bit of distance and do some healing from the things that had happened, which made it a lot easier when it came to obviously doing interviews about the album and just even contemplating putting it out there, because it's a very strange thing to have quite personal traumas out there in the public domain. And it's not something I ever thought I would do or had planned to do at all. And it was really the record that kind of made itself known that it wanted to be written in that way, despite me protesting quite loudly to myself. And, you know, there were moments even just before I handed it over to the label where I was kind of contemplating taking off 5 AM, a song on there that talks about sexual assault. I think ultimately it came down to the idea that I had the last say about what was included and the way in which it was framed. You know, it was an album that I wrote and produced alone. No one heard it until it was finished, so the label hadn't heard it. And I think there was some comfort in that idea that I had complete control, that if I didn't feel comfortable when it came down to it, that I could take a song off or I could decide to reframe something. And yeah, that wasn't going to be taken out of my hands. And to access that vulnerability in my songwriting was a huge leap of faith, really, for the fan base as well.
Yeah. How did they receive it then? It seems like it's been really well received. It's Elton John's favourite record of the year.
I mean, it really has connected with people, unfortunately for all the wrong reasons in a way. I mean, it came out the week that Sarah Everard was murdered. And I think it just, you know, obviously no one could have planned and no one would have wanted to have planned for that to have happened. But it really chimed with the public mood, I think. And we just had I May Destroy You had come out as well not that long before. And I just feel like because we were living through a pandemic, there was just a little bit more of an appetite for dark material and well, maybe not dark material, but just real material. I think in the past, we often patronise audiences and think that people don't want to hear about more difficult subjects. And again, I think, you know, one of the kind of upsides of the pandemic has just been, you know, people are being forced to confront mortality on an everyday basis. And so that makes us less frightened to talk about these things that we would otherwise shy away from. But yeah, the reaction for the fans has been amazing. As I say, especially as I have like a predominantly male fan base as well, I partly feel a little bit like it's a process of, I don't want to say educating people because that sounds really patronising, but there's an element of that, of sharing your experience as a woman and getting them to understand what that feels like. And everyone's just been really receptive. I think obviously there is some uncomfortableness around it. And I found it really interesting actually that during the interview cycle, I think I was only interviewed by one female journalist and none of the men really wanted to ask me about the more difficult aspects, which is lovely of them in some ways. But I think that goes to show, you know, the work that still needs to be done in getting men involved in the conversation about sexual assault, about baby loss, etc. It's like we need them to feel okay about wading in and not to sort of feel like, oh, yeah, I can't touch that. That's too difficult.
Each week, I'll be bringing you QueenCore's very own QueenScope. This will be discussing what's going on in the universe and what might affect you and your energy. This week, the new moon brings focus to love and the energy of Scorpio, who is seductive and intense. So watch out for any old flames coming back into your life. Review how the month has went and set new goals for this coming lunar cycle as we near the end of an action-packed 2021. What's holding you back, if anything, and how can you push through any blockages? Now, back to my chat with Catherine.
There was an article in The Guardian that you might have seen, it was a few weeks ago, and it said that being a woman in pop music specifically, in their words, it described it as unbearable. Have you dealt with issues like this in your career?
Every single goddamn day, yeah, sadly. It is unbearable. It's what I call, you know, what Musicians Union calls microaggressions. Because it doesn't just have to be, you know, someone grabbing your ass or someone trying to grab your tits. It's down to just, you know, when you walk into the venue for soundcheck and people assume that you are there as the girlfriend of the band, or you're in the studio engineering for somebody and people think you're there to make the tea and you're not producing the record. And actually, I do find the microaggressions more difficult to deal with because, you know, I'm quite adept at punching someone in the face if they try and stick their hand up my skirt. But what I'm less adept at is what do you do when you're dealing with a situation where you're not entirely sure whether the other person understands just how much they are undermining you, just how much they are being offensive to you. You know, if you're in a meeting and someone says, oh no, who wrote the song with you, because the assumption is that you couldn't do it on your own, or oh, so who's producing this track, because the assumption is that you couldn't produce yourself, because that's not what women do. And it's very difficult to deal with those situations, because obviously you don't want to go at it with a club hammer, although I have been known to. And it's really tricky. And I know that it's not just me that has often got to the point where you just feel it's really not worth it anymore. And you know, would I not be happier doing something else in a different industry? But then I think, I'm not sure there are many industries that are that different, actually, that are more welcoming to women and more acknowledging of their talents. I found academia to be just as sexist, to be just as unequal in its fair treatment of women and the opportunities that they were given. So yeah, God, that sounds a bit pessimistic, doesn't it? I think my default mode is anger. I've been angry since I was about 8 years old about being a girl. I think I felt very early on that it was deeply, deeply unfair. I remember I went to this really rough school on a council estate, despite my accent now, which I changed when I went to university. And there was this boy at school who was the well-known school pervert, is the only way to say it. And he used to go around just pulling girls' pants down, sticking his hands up their skirts. And no one was doing anything about it. And the only thing I had going for me at school was I was quite tall. And I just decided to sort of take justice into my own hands and went up to him and punched him in the face. And I got suspended from school, and still nothing was done about this guy. And it was, you know, it was sexual assault. It doesn't matter that we were 11 years old. It was really awful. I think from that moment on, I kind of realised that life wasn't fair, and that adults weren't necessarily there to look after you, and that being a girl made you a target. But also that it wasn't expected that you would fight back and that you would be punished for that too. And sadly, it's a pattern that I have seen repeat itself throughout my adult life as well. I've been angry for a really long time. I think that probably forms a big part of my identity and the way that I relate to this idea of the divine feminine, and that I am raging and full of fire, which I think was kind of what drew me very much to the work of Tori Amos. At that point, in that she seemed to be expressing some of that rage that I was feeling in a way that was packaged that an 11-year-old could kind of relate to.
Completely, yeah. I feel like you're an embodiment of Kali energy.
I wish I was more au fait with all the different goddesses, but I vaguely remember which ones are which. That sounds about right. Is that the fiery one?
Absolutely, yes. So she's got blue skin. She's got her tongue out in a sort of dance of rage at all times. And yeah, she's the goddess of, well, life and death, but she sees it as a rebirth. So on one hand, she's the mother, but on the other hand, she will kill you. If you fuck with her.
That does sound like me, actually. Well, I've always, as I was saying about my mum at the beginning, has always been really obsessed with horoscopes. The one thing that I always did kind of stick with me was this idea of being Scorpio, which I am, and the idea of the phoenix kind of rising from the ashes. And that was something I'd always really identified with, and that I tended to have these very kind of low and dark periods of time. But from that, I would kind of regroup and be reborn into something new, a new chapter, a new start. So that really makes sense.
How would you define queen energy?
Oh, so difficult. I guess I kind of think of it as a balance between what we've just been speaking about, actually, the kind of Madonna whore complex. It's kind of, you know, you contain within yourself a kind of purity and a toxicity and a fire and a calmness. And for me, I think the goddess energy is someone that can hold all of that in themselves simultaneously and embrace that.
Yeah, that's exactly how I picture it. Like massive compassion, but also fierce boundaries.
Yeah, and I think as women, we're often encouraged to try and push down certain aspects of ourselves in favour of another, as if you can only fit into one stream or one box at any time. Whereas the reality is that we're all quite multiplicitous, and it's probably just much more kind of realistic to think of yourself as containing, as Walt Whitman said, I contain multitudes. And it's like, I am many things. I am angry, but I am also incredibly compassionate and empathetic. And I think that's what I love about the Anchoress character, is that I'm able to project certain aspects of myself that perhaps in my day-to-day domestic life don't necessarily come to the fore. And I always love it when I meet some of the fans, they always say, oh, you're not that scary in real life. And it's like, because obviously I would be foregrounding the harder elements of the feminine in my music and in that kind of public facing persona. But obviously, of course, I'm not like that on a day to day basis.
Yeah. And that's okay, because as you said, we're multitudes. I know that you've worked with a lot of men in the music industry, like the Manix and Bernard Butler. Would you consider them sort of conscious men?
I think, you know, the Manix for me was my first example of good men. You know, they wrote the song Little Baby Nothing, which almost perfectly embodies the idea of female consciousness and what it feels like to be subject to this kind of male gaze all the time, to be an object of vacant desire. I just thought that was absolutely incredible that men could understand that, and that they are enormously supportive and progressive and really aware. I've worked with men partly because that is, you know, what's the word? That's the climate of the industry. It is predominantly made up of men. And I think as I move forwards with what I do next, I am very consciously trying to choose to work with women where I can. I think when you're starting out, it's really hard to make those calls because you don't necessarily have the power to do that, if that makes sense. It's only once you've kind of gathered a bit of momentum where you have, you know, a little bit more control over what it is that you're doing, that you're able to make those decisions about who you work with. And often when you're starting out, it can be the case of you're working with whoever wants to work with you, which is, again, causes so many problems for so many young women entering the industry. You know, we see the same patterns time and time again of where that can go really, really wrong. So yeah, I think I kind of am programmatically making my plans to include as many women as possible where I can. You know, I know that who's going to be mastering the next record. I know who I'm going to be working with the engineering on. I know who's doing the string arranging, and they're all women. So yeah, you've got to practice what you preach.
So you've mentioned quite a lot of people who inspire you already. Do you have like a top five?
Yeah, I was thinking about this earlier. My top five in terms of sort of divine feminine, queen, goddess, energy artists would probably be Bjork, Tori Amos, PJ Harvey, Diamanda Galas, who is probably more devil energy than goddess, and Fiona Apple, especially for her last record.
It's incredible. I'm so glad she won the Grammy. It's really interesting that you talked about the sort of therapy that you've done. Certainly in my experience of therapy, they talk a lot about being the observer. I don't know if that would be useful in this instance, where it's just being able to take a step back and purely observe others' behaviour and the possible reasons why they're doing that, which are most likely nothing to do with you.
It's so interesting, because the way that having ASD manifests for me is that I find it very difficult to read people. I find it incredibly hard to read people, and it's something I've had to work at a lot. So I cannot always understand if someone is being sarcastic or if somebody has ill intent towards me, especially. I tend to sort of take things at face value, which can be really, really tricky in social situations, especially around men as well. So yeah, that's something I'm having to learn to be a bit better at, and actually just trust my intuition, because I do have great intuition. And I think it's something I had tuned out of, because I'd been told so much as a child that I wasn't good at reading people, that I didn't understand people. Whereas all along, I had the feeling in my stomach when something wasn't right. And I think I just needed to tune into that a little bit more.
Yeah. Jessie G said that as soon as she started doing that, her life changed. Professionally, personally.
It goes back to what we began talking about, which is this idea of the overlap between the logical and the scientific and the spiritual and the religious, and this idea of how therapeutic practices often straddle the two, and you know, all the EDMR therapy and the trauma therapy that I've had. And I didn't realise, as I say, this clinical psychologist was going to be encouraging me to trust my instinct, to trust my gut. to trust those somatic feelings that were coming through. And that was a real revelation for me, just that those two worlds were not separated, that actually science and medicine does recognize instinct and gut feeling.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I guess in this kind of spiritual reading, it would be a kind of weaving of the masculine and feminine energy, because on one hand you do have that very linear science, and then you've got the more spiritual emotional side, so it's kind of the perfect mix.
Yeah, so as a queer theorist, I would just completely refute the gendering of any energies, because I just feel like we are all so, it's so interesting, obviously a lot of the cultural discourse that's happening now talking about transgender politics is so close to what queer theory has been saying probably for the last 20 years. So I find it really fascinating that people find it quite shocking that we would talk about gender as being constructed or ascribed or invented, whereas for queer theorists, we've always thought that. So yeah, I just kind of ignore all kind of gender attributions and just think of us all as human beings, which is what I feel most comfortable with. But yeah, I guess science is traditionally associated with that kind of masculine and rational energy, isn't it? And we do gender them, which is a shame as well. And that brings us back to our discussion about producers as well, doesn't it? Because that's where the assumptions come from, that girls don't like science and girls don't like engineering and girls aren't interested in technology, only if we keep being told we don't.
Exactly. Yeah. So lastly, the last round is I've got some random names for you to consider. Are they queen or not? And the reasons why. So first up, I've got Aretha Franklin.
Oh, hell yes. Definitely. That voice alone, that's goddess energy, isn't it?
What about Britney Spears?
Oh, definitely. I probably wouldn't have said yes until the last year or so, and kind of seeing what she's been through. And I think there's been a very successful blurring of her true narrative. But absolutely, if you look at what she's endured and what dignity she's endured that with, incredible. A lot of respect for her now.
It's quite exciting to see what's going to come next from her. Is she going to make more music?
Do you know what? I really actually hope that she doesn't. Because I get the impression that she's wanted to retire for a really long time and she's just been a cash cow. And I actually, with the best will in the world, would like her just to disappear and lead the quiet life that she wants to have, if that's what she wants.
You can really see it on those videos of her performing in Vegas and stuff like that. She's really just does not want to be there.
Yeah, so horrific. It's just absolutely horrific. So yeah, I hope she gets to go and do what she wants to do now.
And the next one is Bernard Butler.
Does he have goddess energy? I think he's somebody that understands what it's like to be a woman in music. I found him to be very empathetic to work with in a way that not a lot of men have been. Whether that means that he himself has goddess energy, I don't know, or whether he just makes a real effort to understand the feminine, I think would probably be more accurate. He is an incredible musician, but that has no gender, I don't think.
Yeah, that's great to hear that he was good to work with. And lastly, I've got man of the moment, Lil Nas X.
Definitely an absolute queen in all senses of the word. I don't know that it's necessarily my cup of tea, to use that old cliche, musically, but I don't think that means that you can't appreciate somebody's cultural kind of importance, if that makes sense.
Completely, yeah. Yeah, that was something I really wanted to ask you, was the idea of a songwriter, do they always need to have a message, like a social message?
No, I don't think that they do. I think music has so many different cultural applications and so many different purposes. You know, it's just as of value and just as important to be a songwriter who makes that anthem that's going to bring everyone, you know, up on the dance floor on a Friday or Saturday night, as it is to make something that's a protest song. They're both equally valid. And I think you just have to follow your own calling and you have to follow what it is that you want to do as a writer. I don't tend to hierarchize art and be like, this is high art and this is low art, you know, or this is great songwriting and this is just like crap pop. I think like great pop music is really high art as well. I don't like the snobbery that there is around different forms of songwriting at all.
Totally, because you can deliver a message in so many ways, right? It can be like a story, it can be a full-on protest song.
Populism is in itself so powerful, you know. You can be an incredibly successful artist that may, on the surface, not be saying anything socially. And I mean, look at Britney, for instance. I don't think you can look back at Britney's back catalogue and say that any of those songs themselves carried an inherent message of feminism. But look at what she's done over the last year with her court case. As a cultural icon, as somebody that's operating in the world, you don't have to do it through the songs themselves. There's many ways in which you can enact change.
We have so much power to wield. It's incredible.
And now I'm thinking about the idea of Britney coming back with an album that's actually written about all that she's been through. I can't see her doing that, but wouldn't it be great if she did?
I'm so ready for that.
Maybe her and Kesha could sit down and write something together.
Speaking to Catherine shows how you can turn a painful lesson into vulnerable art and connect with others with similar experiences and bring awareness to the fact that this is okay. We don't need to hide in the shadows with issues like assault or miscarriage. And if anything, these issues need more attention in order to educate people on how they affect us. I've got nothing but gratitude to Catherine for being so brave and making others feel so seen. That's the end of season one already. Thank you to all my guests and everyone who has supported, followed, listened and sent their comments and questions. You can find me at Queen Core Pod on Twitter and Instagram and the Queen Core Podcast on TikTok. I love to answer all your comments, questions and DMs and love to hear from as many of you as possible. The Queen Core Podcast has been co-produced and presented by me, Carolyn King, co-produced and edited by Helena Rufai, with music by The Vantees. Laguna, 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 Laguna.